From NPR is made possible in part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Today we take a look at Iraq through the eyes of Iraqis that journalist Matthew McAllister met prior to the war, during his imprisonment at the outset of the war, after his release, and in the aftermath of the regime of Saddam Hussein. These stories are at the heart of a new book McAllister has written. It's titled Blinded by the Sunlight, Emerging from the Prison of Saddam's Iraq. McAllister was in Baghdad during the last days of Saddam's regime. He arrived in February of 2003. When the war began in March, he covered it from hospitals and bunkers. A few days later, he was arrested by the Iraqi secret police and held for 8 days in a prison that Saddam used as a tool of terror, a prison McAllister calls the last circle in every Iraqi's hell. Matt McAllister is a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter who has covered conflicts in Northern Ireland, the Balkans, Israel, the Palestinian territories, Afghanistan, and Iraq. He is Newsday's United Nations Bureau Chief. He also serves as foreign correspondent for the paper covering the Middle East. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion with your questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call in the Champaign-Urbana area. The number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. If it would be a long-distance call, use the toll-free number 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. The toll-free number is good anywhere in the U.S. Matt McAllister's book, Blinded by the Sunlight, Emerging from the Prison of Saddam's Iraq, is published by HarperCollins. He is also the author of Beyond the Mountains of the Damned, The War Inside Kosovo. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Matt McAllister, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon. Good to talk to you again.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be back.
You note at the outset of the war, Iraq had been imprisoned for 35 years, 24 years of Saddam Hussein's direct rule, and another 11 when he ruled in all but name. And you say that when the regime fell, Iraq could not quite believe that it was free. It did not know if there were regime guards at the door, if they had really gone forever. Only one thing was certain. Now there were new guards with different rules from another country. How do the Iraqis you know see their situation today?
Every Iraqi I've ever met has many contradicting opinions and views and feelings about the situation at the moment. I mean, within half an hour, you can have three completely different opposing opinions from the same person about the Americans, about the rate of reconstruction, about Saddam Hussein, or about the resistance. And to me, the confusion is completely understandable. And I mean, you noted at the beginning that this country was a large prison, and in a sense that's the main point of my book, and I think we need to sort of focus on that a lot in as we look at Iraq. When people come out of prison in any country, they're traumatized, and a lot of people say, oh, you know, I'd rather go back to my cell. Things made sense there. And this is 25 million people coming out of prison all at the same time.
Yeah. When did you begin to see that Iraq under Saddam had been one huge prison?
I sensed it when I was first there in 2001. The restrictions that we were put under as reporters were as extreme as any I've come across. And the fear among ordinary people, I mean, I frankly never had a single honest conversation with an Iraqi during that first trip to Iraq way back in early 2001. You know, it was totalitarianism in its purest form, really. And Stalin, of course, was Saddam's great role model, and he did a good job at mimicking that and turning the entire country into a place where there were real walls, real prisons, but also virtual walls, and everyone spied on everyone else, and no one knew who to trust. So really, no one trusted anyone.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, speaking of trust, maybe even tell us about the man who was your driver, Yusuf Aziz. When you first met him, you wondered if he was too good to be true. When did you meet, and how was it that you began to trust him, and why did he trust you?
Yeah, I mean, still good questions, and I guess you just have to ultimately take a leap of faith. But I met him outside the Palestine Hotel, which is where most of the journalists ended up during the war. This was about a month or so before, and it was purely by chance, and he sort of walked out and saw me looking a bit lost, and I was, in fact, looking for a driver. So I said, you know, okay, I'll hire you for the day. And within the first hour or so, Yusuf, who spoke pretty good English and has a very sort of naughty, independent glint in his eye, said this sentence. He said, Saddam is a difficult man. And I, you know, my jaw almost dropped, because saying that in that at that time, and this was a year ago or so, was potentially suicidal. If I'd sort of, you know, if I'd reported him, you know, he would have been taken away. He became more frank. I became more frank. We sort of edged towards each other, towards trusting each other. It took a long time. I mean, I still, for several days, for, you know, a couple of weeks, I still didn't know if he was for real. But he started, you know, helping out in ways that you know, surely only he could be. It would endanger his life, so he had to be a trustworthy guy.
Yeah. Well, it wasn't long after the war began. You and Yusuf are talking, and you think there's no way Saddam's regime is going to survive, but all of a sudden he's quite fearful. He thought, God, Saddam is going to prevail. And I think this story is telling about the grip that Saddam had on everyone, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, at that stage, it was the early days of the war. And, there was some fighting in Umm Qasr and Basra. And it seemed that, in fact, the Iraqis had shot down an Apache helicopter that day. And suddenly there was this surge of unity, it seemed to me, and seemed to Yusuf, seemed to everyone in Iraq, that, in fact, the Iraqis were going to fight back and were holding the advancing forces back. And would, in fact, prevail. And, you know, looking back on it, what a delusion that was. And I tried to assure Yusuf that this was not going to happen and that there was nothing on the planet that was going to prevent an American victory, and a pretty rapid one at that. But no, he suddenly lost faith and he started telling me the Americans will not fight in the cities. They don't have the bravery to do it.
Hmm. Well, and this is a man who's family's situation was altered, changed at the beginning of Saddam's rule, right? I mean, his father was affected.
Yeah, his father was in fact one of the chief detectives. And when Saddam was a young man, this was before the Ba'athists were in power. When Saddam was a young man, his father had signed an arrest warrant for young Saddam Hussein for anti-government activities. So they were not a popular family, but they kept their head down, and Yusuf actually married a woman, his very lovely woman called Shafika, from a very prominent Sunni Arab family. So in a sense, he married into a little bit of protection. And even though he was a quiet dissenter and he had no love for the regime, he kept his head down. I mean, one of his brothers-in-law was a senior bodyguard in the regime. So he was a very smart guy. He still is. I saw him about a month ago, and he's still a very good friend.
He's well.
Yep. Very well.
You believed the war was necessary, even if it was being waged under false pretexts, because Saddam's regime was so brutal. But at the end of the book, you have some pretty tough words for the U.S. What are your thoughts about the war today?
My thoughts are relatively similar. I still feel that the war was justified, but as you say, I almost felt that the issue of weapons of mass destruction wasn't relevant. Clearly in the past, Saddam had them. But we now see that, you know, that was probably quite some years ago. I never really felt that Saddam was a threat to his neighbors. I felt that Saddam was a threat to his own people. And, in fact, he was a brutal threat. I mean, hundreds of thousands of people died at his hands. The litmus test for me is to ask Iraqis now how they feel about having Saddam in prison. They're by and large delighted. They have very mixed feelings about the occupation, but to be rid of Saddam is to be able to speak and to talk and to be free in ways that, you know, they'd never imagined. I mean, they never really thought this would happen, and the only way it was ever going to happen, given his incredible grip on power, was a war. And it's a horrible thing, but that was the reality. It was the only thing that was going to stop him.
Well, now the terror is less, but the security situation is so poor.
Yeah.
How is that affecting people?
Oh, very, very badly. It's very depressing for a lot of people. There are two different forces going on, different movements going on in Iraq at the moment. And the attacks of the day before yesterday were preceded by a genuinely, or potentially genuinely, historical moment, and that was the agreement on this interim constitution, which, as written, is a pretty remarkable document. It's very progressive and very similar to what, you know, we would see as a democratic constitution. And then, of course, the next day there's this catastrophe, and it's a terrible, terrible carnage, and clearly done with a level of coordination and expertise that suggests, to me at least, Al-Qaeda. I mean, I don't remember an incident between 2 days ago and September the 11th that involved quite so many well-coordinated suicide bombers. I mean, in one target, the shrine in Baghdad, I believe there were four bombers who all exploded their charges at different times according to where the crowd was. That's a huge sort of commitment and huge level of sophistication. And I think the Iraqi people feel distraught and depressed by this, because as they move towards more representational government, it's very likely that the political violence will increase. Certainly capturing Saddam hasn't done anything to stop it. And if you ever wanted a whole host of vulnerable targets, well, imagine election day in Iraq with millions of people standing outside schools and courthouses, lining up, vulnerable as anything, to suicide bombers. I mean, it could be the greatest day in modern Iraqi history, or it could be utter carnage.
Hmm. That was one of the questions I had day before yesterday. Wasn't this scene, as a day where something could go terribly wrong, and couldn't the targets, have been? Didn't somebody realize that these places would be targeted?
I think it's impossible to protect. I mean, again, if you think about all of these targets that get hit, it's milling swarms of people. Now, on Ashura, the Holy Shia Day, we're talking hundreds of thousands of people here. There simply isn't the manpower, even with the Iraqi or the occupation forces, to frisk everyone. Now, let's say that there was, and that you managed to produce a sort of hermetic cordon around the shrine, or around a polling booth, or around a police recruitment station, which was a target about a month ago in Iskandaria. Well, then you've just got another level of people lining up outside. And don't they need to be protected? So at what stage can you protect people, and what stage are they vulnerable? And I think when you're talking the vast numbers that congregate on holy days in Iraq, and vast numbers that would congregate at an election, it's simply practically impossible. And I think that's what makes Kofi Annan and other officials at the UN and the U.S. so very worried about election day. It could be just a catastrophe.
Mm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Journalist Matthew McAllister is our guest this afternoon in this portion of the program. He is the author of Blinded by the Sunlight, Emerging from the Prison of Saddam's Iraq. Listeners, you can join the discussion with questions, comments. Here are the numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. 800-222-9455. 9455. Shortly after you had that conversation with Youssef about his fears that Saddam would prevail, you were arrested. What happened?
I was about to file a story. It was 1 o'clock in the morning, third or fourth night of the war, and I was in my hotel room, and there was a bang on the door. And usually, when there was a bang on the door, it was a coded knock, a rather primitive one, that my buddies and I, the other reporters in the Palestine, had instituted precisely for this reason, so that if we needed to stash the unregistered satellite phones that we all had to hide them from the intelligence guys who were combing the hallways, then we would have a few seconds to do so. Well, this was not the coded knock. I went to the door, looked through the peephole, and there were a dozen intelligence officers there. So obviously I let them in. And that began, a very long night that involved packing up all our stuff, ultimately being taken down the freight elevator where no one could see us leaving the hotel, and being handcuffed, told that we were under arrest, and driven out to Abu Ghraib prison on the outskirts of Baghdad, where I'd been before previous October on a story, so I knew its reputation.
Yeah. Well, when the security men came into the room, you were worried that you were going to be expelled. Mm. But it was so much worse than that.
Yeah.
The prison, Abu Ghraib, you describe as the last circle in every Iraqi's hell. Would you describe it for us?
It was a huge place. It still is a huge place. And ironically, built by an American company in the 60s. And it was built as a beacon of progressive reformatory prison, progressive reformatory prison in Iraq, which was trying to become a very modern country in those days. And over the Saddam era, it just became, like I say, hell. Overcrowding was, over 20,000 people. I found the chief doctor of Abu Ghraib after the war, who told me that the drug use addiction was rampant. Tuberculosis particularly was endemic, to the point where, and conditions were so bad, that he used to see perfectly healthy men ask tubercular men to spit into their mouths so that they could become infected by the disease and sort of be upgraded to the tuberculosis ward, where they had beds and air coolers, even if it meant losing their lives ultimately. They just can stand being in the regular prison where there was violence and torture and of course execution. There were regular executions in the hanging room, and the parts of the prison that were run by the more hardcore of Saddam's security services had their own more summary executions.
Hmm. That head doctor, Dr. Fadil Fanghul, tell us more about him. It goes to speaking of what one might do to survive and to try and, within one's power, do what one could.
Yes, he's a lovely man. Still works at a hospital in Baghdad, and there he was driving out every day to this prison, making almost no money. He did it for the love of it, if you can believe it. He would go into this heart of darkness and try and do some good for the patients, giving, looking at their ailments, their hemorrhoids. If they needed Valium, he would reluctantly give them. He would try and help out the psychiatric patients, of whom there were, many. And he would, but he also do it for his own personal reasons. And he told me that he loved it, sitting in his office, which was like a private space, the only safe private space he could get in Iraq. And the irony is that he was in prison. And because he was in prison, he could have frank conversations with former ministers and generals who'd been thrown in prison by Saddam for disloyalty or trumped-up charges or whatever. And so they could sit in his office and drink tea and sort of have a little salon and speak about, politics, which you couldn't speak about politics in Iraq unless it was, Ba'ath Party sort of nonsense. and be frank. And he had this freedom in, at the heart of the worst prison in the large prison of the country. So he kept on coming back, even though, you know, he there was nothing really in it for him.
Hmm. Once a person was captive in Abu Ghraib, was there any hope of getting out?
There was, actually, yes. There were, by and large, most of the prisoners, I would say, in there were criminals or convicted of crimes, not necessarily fairly. So some of them would be released, but a lot of them would just get lost in there and spend, you know, year after year after year. The political prisoners, especially, I mean, they had much less hope of being released because, of course, they would be considered a threat to the state. Or, you know, they would just be executed.
How did that regime keep its thumb on everyone, on his secret police, on his inner circle?
Power, just sheer power. I realized this when we were being driven to the prison, and I think I mention it in the book. I suddenly realized what keeps totalitarian regimes in power. It's just guns, walls, cars, roads. It's infrastructure and the willingness to kill. And he, from the top down, he was willing to kill, and that instills fear, and ruthlessness trickles down. And then it's supported by paranoia and by he would essentially construct it, because Saddam personally built the Mukhabarat, the intelligence agency, and part of it was that they had to spy on each other, and they even had to spy on themselves. They had to write reports on what they'd been doing the whole time, and it never ended. I mean, this sort of spying in the sense that you would sort of spy on your neighbors kind of thing, not espionage spying. And I found these notes in the floor of the prison after the war, which are the most trivial, absurd, sort of almost comical telling tales on fellow intelligence officers inside the prison. You know, so-and-so stole two blankets. And I mean, really, when you get to that level of triviality and paranoia, then you know that the upper echelons of society, when it comes to real political challenges, are not never going to find strength and a voice to challenge the status quo.
Yeah, and everything was recorded, like Nazi Germany.
Yeah.
Maybe you would tell us about two brothers that you met, Akil and Jaber Husseini?
Yes.
Yeah, tell us about them.
Sorry, they were... I'm sorry, I don't quite remember.
These were, if I'm recalling correctly, these were two brothers, Shia, who had photographs for you. I've confused
right.
it all. But anyway, they talked with you about surviving this Shia uprising after the first Iraq War.
Yes, I mean there was a family I spoke to after the war. Jaber Husseini was a witness to this awful mass grave, and I also spoke to a family that was a victim of the mass grave, and. This was a family of nine brothers, and five of them, including an eight-year-old who was playing marbles in the street at the time, were taken away. And they ended up in this huge mass grave in Mahawil, which is just south of Baghdad, around about 3,000 people, civilians by and large, were executed there in 1991. Now, rather astonishingly, after the war, I came across someone, I can't say who it was, but that was the agreement we made, who gave me photographs of the killings actually happening. The killings that Jaber Husseini, the local farmer whose land it was, witnessed. But as you know, it's relatively easy to find witnesses to these things, but these guys were so proud of what they were doing that they took snapshots of themselves standing over blindfolded men, women, and children in the trenches, with their Kalashnikovs pointing at them and doing V signs. I mean, it's actually in the book, a couple of those pictures. And I have a bunch more that there wasn't room for them in the book. And I've seen this elsewhere. I mean, in the Balkans, the paramilitaries, Serbian paramilitaries in Kosovo, you know, took bunches of snapshots of themselves. And it's this delusion that, you know, you're never going to be held responsible for this, and also that this is actually sort of something to be proud of, something to record, even if it's just for you. And I can only imagine that every now and then they would sort of take the pictures out and, you know, remember fond times. I mean, it's mind-boggling, I think.
Yeah. Well, you know, I know that there were postcards made of lynchings, you know, in the United States.
Right.
So let's talk with a listener. Caller on line one in Champaign County. Good afternoon.
Hi. You've evoked the ambivalence that Iraqis have now. And one of the things I think constantly needs to be repeated is that one of the things they're ambivalent about is our U.S.'s past support for the Saddam Hussein regime. I'm sure they remember that, and their Shiites particularly remember being betrayed at the time of the first Gulf War when they were urged to uprise and then were betrayed. But I just wanted to point that out. But I also have an anecdote from someone I know who's Iraqi-American, whose nephew is in the same prison you were in, and he tells the story. It's pretty ghastly. I guess there are about 13,000 people in the prison now held by the U.S. forces. Mm. The story he tells is that his nephew was told that they had a picture of his father with Saddam Hussein, and they wanted him to tell everything about it, and the interrogator said, the nephew said that I don't believe it, it's not true, and the interrogator said, you were calling us a liar, mm-hmm. and they hit him with a steel bar on his leg, and apparently he is still suffering from this interrogation wound. So I'm just...
Is his name Mohammed Fakhri, by any chance?
I don't think I want to say any names, actually.
Yeah, I know.
I think there's probably more than one instance, but it's someone in Chicago area who's related this to me. So I
I know this story well because in my book is the story of there were two American citizens, Iraqi Americans, who were in the same part of the prison that I was in.
I'm talking about what's happening now.
No.
Oh, he's there now. Oh,
yes,
sorry.
This is someone who was picked up by the U.S.
Oh, right.
And who was said, why would the U.S. interrogators are saying, we have a picture of your father with Saddam Hussein, tell us all about his relationship. And the guy says, no, you don't, show it to me. And the American interrogators said, you're calling us liars. And they hit him with a steel bar, and he has a wound on his leg, apparently, that's still afflicting him now. He's been in for 5 months. Mm. So I'm just pointing this out. It's outrageous. It's just... it's unconscionable. We are becoming, obviously it's a long way to go to be like it, but it's not so exceptional, dictatorship. I mean, Suharto was awful in Indonesia and ruled by terror. There was a bloodbath there to enforce the terror of his... some of this was while Wolfowitz was ambassador to Indonesia, too. So I just... I'm sorry, I just had to contribute that. It's not a question, but... I since you were in the same prison that this gentleman is still in, by U.S. actors.
I do find it a little disconcerting to see Abu Ghraib used again as a prison, and I think quite a lot of Iraqis, I think people are mixed. They feel that, look, there are criminals, and here is a ready-made prison, so we may as well use it. But on the other hand, it was such a symbol for Saddam's terror that... it would be a little like using Robben Island in South Africa to some Iraqis as a prison again, and there's real, again, ambivalence about that issue as well.
Yeah. Well, you asked people at one point after Saddam's regime had fallen, what should happen to Abu Ghraib, and you got a number of different kinds of responses. What did people tell you?
It was very mixed, and. So often with Iraqis, they change their mind. And Saad Jassim, the Iraqi-American who was there for 7 years, changed his mind over the course of a few months. Initially, he told me that he wanted it to be pulled down and destroyed. And then more recently, he said, no, we need it. You know, we need that prison because there are criminals on the loose in Iraq and we need to lock them up. And Abu Ghraib actually intimidates people and will make them behave properly. Whereas another intelligence officer who actually had worked there, who I tracked down after the war, told me rather to my surprise that he thought that it was a terrible place with terrible memories, and should be closed and never used again and not even used as a museum, which is what some people also wanted to be turned into, a museum like Robben Island in South Africa or Tall Slaying in Cambodia.
Hmm. What would you have liked to see happen to Abu Ghraib?
I do think that part of it should be a museum. I have to abdicate and say it's really not my country, and my experience there doesn't compare with what Iraqis have gone through in that prison. And in fact, it's important to stress that. I mean, when I talk to Iraqis and mention that I was there for 8 days, I mean they're amused, but they're not very impressed. You know, they say, "Oh well, I did 5 years, and I wasn't tortured, and they were." So I don't feel I have a claim on it.
Yeah. Although it appears that you were very lucky to have gotten out.
Yeah, I mean, all the intelligence officers I have spoken to find it very amusing, but sort of in an eyebrow-raising way that we did get out. They always say, "Well, how did you do that?" And I was quite keen to find out myself afterwards, so spent many months tracking down my chief interrogator to try and work that one out.
What was it like meeting him after after the wars? After the Saddam is gone.
Very strange. It was
having tea with him.
I know. I was incredibly nervous, and it was. I was a bit shocked because I'd been trying to arrange it for weeks and months, and had been told that I didn't have a chance of doing it. And then suddenly my translator sort of burst into my room and said, "Abu Ibrahim is here. He'll be here in 30 seconds. So I think I sort of was a bit shaky, and I certainly was a bit sweaty, and didn't really know what to do with myself. And then, into the room walks, into my hotel room walks, the man that had power of life and death over us. And slightly to my surprise, we embraced and quite sort of hugged quite tightly in, I guess, the odd fraternity of people who've been through a traumatic experience. I mean, I've no idea if it was traumatic for him, but it was for me. And yet, now the tables were a little bit turned, and he was very nervous as well. I could tell he was very uptight, and it was with a lot of convincing through intermediaries that I persuaded him to come, because, of course, it could have been a trap. I would never, that would have been a sort of violation of journalistic ethics. But he didn't know that. So he came, and he was very anxious, and I'm not sure who was more nervous, him or me.
Abu Ibrahim and others like him, the interrogators and the guards, what were their lives like outside prison, and what are their lives like today?
Their lives outside prison, as far as I've been able to tell, were bizarrely normal. I mean, I had lunch at various of their houses, and you wouldn't tell that they're not lawyers or mechanics or shopkeepers. They have normal living rooms and kids running in, and they're friendly with their neighbors, and in fact, it's quite easy to find. I found us some documents. This is how I found a lot of them, with addresses. And so I would go to the neighborhood, and the addresses in street addresses in Baghdad are very confusing. And so you just sort of stop and say, "Hey, do you know where so and so, the Mahabharat guy, is?" And they'd go, "Oh yeah, he's over there." So they weren't exactly hiding, and they were sort of integrated into the community, and many of them were. Really, it's a strange step, but really quite nice. And yet, I'd also know what they'd been responsible for by definition. I mean, you can't spend, 15, 20, 30 years in the Mahabharat and not partake in torture and sending people to their deaths. And that's the thing about, bad people sometimes. They can be very charming and very normal and prosaic and polite. And now a lot of them, a huge amount of them, are just sitting at home or getting on with getting on with their lives. In fact, I know, but not all of them, you know, will get away with it. There are revenge killings, and I do know of someone who has identified where his torturer, one of his former torturers, is working, and this person plans to go in one day and shoot him dead.
Hmm. Another one of these fellows that you've met and interviewed is a man by the name of Abu Tiba. What a remarkable meeting that must have been for you to sit down with him. He was with Saddam and some of Saddam's family on April 9th.
Yeah, I mean, it was one of the most amazing meetings I've ever had in my career. I mean, he was one of Uday Hussein's personal bodyguards, and I tracked him down after the war, living again a very quiet life north of Baghdad. And he had been with the family on April the 9th and until 4 or 5 days later. And just really extraordinary stories he told about being with Uday as they drove along a Baghdad street, and on the other side of the street were American soldiers, and Uday sort of looking at them and disparaging them and laughing at them. And, you know, only yards away. The other amazing thing, really, is that even while the Americans were, in Baghdad, Saddam was out and about in public, and at one stage went to a mosque and prayed along with Qusay and Uday and met his people. And this was after his statue had been pulled down on the other side of town. They were, incredibly brave, I suppose, to still be around. And it wasn't until 4 or 5 days after the fall of Baghdad that the family actually split up and decided to leave the capital. And that's the last time that Abu Tiba saw Uday.
Now, someone like him, what are his hopes for Iraq?
Hard to tell. I didn't get into politics with him. I was just so keen to soak up his recent experiences. I think it varies. Now, some of them, some of the intelligence guys I spoke to, seemed resigned. One man, Abu Thar, who is my interrogator's very good friend and a long-time and quite senior Mukhabarat officer, seemed resigned to it. He was not fond of the Americans, but he just wanted a job. In fact, he wanted to be hired as an intelligence officer by the Americans. He wanted to get back in the saddle. But I think Abu Ibrahim, my interrogator, he said, "I love Saddam Hussein," when I asked him about Saddam, and this was last summer. And I wouldn't be surprised, and I haven't seen him since then, I wouldn't be surprised if he was in some way involved in the resistance, because he seemed very diehard to me and very determined, and he was very, very bright, very calm individual.
Let's talk with another listener. Caller on a cell phone, line one. Hi.
Hi. You said I'd like to make a couple comments and several questions. One of the admonitions against going to war in Iraq was that people were concerned that with an American presence over there, that they would become a target for terrorists, and that I understand there are a lot of terrorists crossing the border there from Pakistan, and that there are now a lot of terrorist cells there that weren't present when Saddam Hussein was there. And it's my understanding that Saddam was very fearful of terrorist organizations. Not being a religious person, he was scared of fundamentalists. So I wonder if this isn't, what we're seeing isn't a self-fulfilling prophecy and is, in fact, a result of the war there. The second question I had is, when Saddam Hussein was captured, it was my understanding that a lot of the mainstream newspapers in Europe were talking about that the Kurds, in fact, had captured Saddam Hussein. So I wanted to ask if he had any comment on that. And then the third thing was, why weren't American forces keeping track of civilian deaths there as a result of the war? And are there any figures on civilian casualties? And if so, who's been gathering that information? the last point I would ask the interviewer today is, you know, there have been other dictators like Idi Amin and that have had reigns of terror, and would he recommend that that in itself is a reason for us to go in? And I'm not saying that it isn't, but, and I'll hang up and let him address those questions.
That's all. Those are a lot of questions, and we've only got about 5 minutes left.
Okay, I'll deal with them very quickly if I can. Yes, I think that the war was justified on the human rights grounds. I could go on longer, but I won't. The United States military, I don't think, or any military, keeps tags of the number of civilians that they kill. But there is an organization run by a friend of mine, actually, an NGO, that's chronicling this and trying to get compensation for civilians. Also, several news organizations like the Associated Press have done surveys and tried to calculate how many civilians died in the war. I don't think there's any truth whatsoever to the Kurds capturing Saddam beforehand. That's a conspiracy theory. As for terrorism, clearly there are terrorists now in Iraq that weren't there before the war. Now, is that a good thing because it's distracting them from attacking, the United States, for example? Or is it a bad thing and that has just encouraged more jihadis to join the fight against American forces? I don't know. And I think history will need to wait to find out.
Okay. We have just a couple of minutes left now. What would you like to say in way of summing up?
Well, I feel very strongly that because of the restrictions that we were all, as journalists, placed under Saddam, we just couldn't get the truth out. It was impossible. It was I think I write in the book, it was a dirty, compromising experience. And it really was. And I don't, it wasn't fun for any of us to not be able to get to the truth. And this occupation, this project, is going to go on for years, whoever wins in November. There will be an American presence in Iraq for a long time to come. It's already cost hundreds of billions of dollars and will cost many more. And many more lives, probably American lives and Iraqi lives. And my feeling is that we need to understand their country, understand the Iraqi people and what they've been through. If we're going to be so engaged in this country, in this what I think is truly a historic project, whether it's good or bad, we'll see. But hopefully, in a sense, that's what drove me to write the book and to try and use my brief insight into what it was like in those 35 years, because if we're going to look forward successfully, we're going to have to look back at the trauma that they've all been through.
There we'll leave it. Matt McAllister, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Matt McAllister is the author of Blinded by the Sunlight, Emerging from the Prison of Saddam's Iraq. The book is published by HarperCollins. Matt McAllister is a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter who has covered conflicts around the world. He is Newsday's United Nations bureau chief. He also serves as a foreign correspondent for the paper covering the Middle East. Again, his book, Blinded by the Sunlight, published by HarperCollins. It's 11 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time. Settlement prices are in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason. Well, we'll get to Todd in just a moment. Let me give you this afternoon's forecast for Illinois and Indiana. Cloudy with showers and thunderstorms becoming more widespread in central and southern Illinois. Heavy rainfall is likely. Highs this afternoon ranging from 47 in northwestern Illinois to 68 in southeastern Indiana. And I'm told now that Todd is in place, and he has those numbers for us. Todd?
Oh, I was in place. I just wasn't paying attention, Celeste. I was having a discussion with Dave Dickey, who's the director of the agricultural programming here at the station, and didn't hear you throw that to me. Here in the Ag Office, futures finished the day like this. Actually, at the Chicago Board of Trade, let's take a look at those numbers. March wheat for the day, a high at 372.5, a low at 365, a settlement price there at 370.75, a penny and a quarter higher. Futures, for the most part, across the Board of Trade, grade moved lower and then bounced just a bit for the day. May contract 379.5, the high, the low at 371.75, settled up near that high end, 378.5, up 2.25 for the wheat. July contract 382, the high, the low at 375, a settlement price at 381.5, up 1.75. September futures 385.5, the high, the low at 380.25, settlement price at 385. They were 1.5 higher. In December futures for the wheat, 395, the high, the low at 388, settlement price 394. And they finished up 2 on the day. Now the March corn, 291.75, the high, the low at 288.25, settlement price at 290.75. They finished a quarter higher today. The May futures 299, the high, the low at 294.5, a settlement price there 297, down 0.75%. July contract 302, the high, the low at 298, settlement price $3.75. 0.75% higher on the day. In September, 296 high, low at 292.5, a settlement price 295. They finished off 1. December corn 293, the high, the low at 289.75, a settlement price at 292, a penny and a quarter lower. And the March futures 293.75 high, low at 291. A settlement, 293, down 1. July contract in the corn pit, 295.75, high, low at 294. Settlement price at 295.25, down 3/4. And December corn, 267, the high, low at 265.25. A settlement price at 266.5. They were down 0.5 cents on the day. The March oats at 154 for the high, the low at 151.5. A settlement price, 152.5, down 0.25. And the May contract, 157.75 high, a low at 154.25. Settlement price at 157.25. They were down 0.5 cents on the day. From the soy complex now, March beans down 9.5 cents. 944 the high, the low at 923.5, a settlement price at 932.5. That was well above the low for the day. It was still down 9.5 cents on the day. The March contract 946 the high, the low 926. That's a 20 cent trading range settled right in the middle. 936.5, down 6.5 cents on the day. July soybeans 932 the high, the low at 916.25, settled 925, down 2.75. September futures 815 the high, the low at 805, settled 811, up 0.5 cent. And the November beans, 742 the high, the low at 730.5, settled 739.5. They were 1.75 cents higher. January contract 739 the high, the low at 731, up on near that high for the finish for the day at 738.5, 4 cents higher actually. And the March beans, 736 the high, the low at 728, settled 734. They were 4 higher as well. March bean meal, 284.20 on the high, the low at 279.50, a settlement price at 282.80. They were down 30 for the day. And the May contract for the meal at the Board of Trade, 286 the high, the low at 281.30, settlement price at 284.20. They finished down 110. March bean oil, 33.62 the high, the low at 32.80, settled 32.95, down 67. And the May oil, 33.45 for the high, the low at 32.60, settlement price there 32.79. Down 71 on the day. Now here's Celeste with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange.
Thanks, Todd. A mixed day today on the Mercantile Exchange. Let's take a look at feeder cattle first. March feeder cattle, the high 88.50, the low 86.80, the settlement 87.17.5, that down 57.5. April 87.05, the high 84.85, the low 85.25, the settlement, that down 112.5. May 88.30, the high 85.75, the low 86.17.5, the settlement, that down 125. August feeder cattle, today's high 89.50, the low 87.50, the settlement 88.37.5, that down 62.5. March live cattle 82.50, the high 81.75, the low, the settlement 81.90, that up 90. April 80.45, the high 79, even the low 79.42.5, the settlement, that up 110. June 74.70, the high 72.75, the low 73.85, the settlement, that up 10. August live cattle 74.40, the high 72.85, the low, the settlement 73.65, that down 37.5. April lean hog 60.90, the high 59.60, the low 60.47.5, the settlement, that down 42.5. May 61.30, the high 59.95, the low 61.30, the settlement, that up 50. June lean hog 66.50, the high 64.70, the low 66.25, the settlement, that down 7.5. July lean hog 62.65, the high, the low 61.47.5, the final price 62.27.5, that down 45. March pork bellies 95.40, the high 94.35, the low, the settlement 95.25, that down 115. May 96.65, the high 95.50, the low 96.07 and a half, the settlement, that down 160. The Dow Jones Industrial Average currently down 7 points at 10,586. The NASDAQ is 17 higher at 2050, while the S&P 500 is up 3 points at 1154.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners: Illini Studio, Champaign; Illinois Graphics Incorporated, Bloomington; Lincoln Diagnostics Incorporated, Decatur; and the High School of St. Thomas More, Champaign. These business partners join the Friends of WILL in making great programs possible. Thank you.
This week, a Prairie Home Companion comes to you from the Grand Ole Opry House in Nashville, Tennessee. Great mandolinist Sam Bush sitting in with a shoe band. Singer Susie Boggess. Great guitarist Tommy Emmanuel. The Old Crow Medicine Show. The shoe band Guy Noir Radio Private Eye. The Ketchup Advisory Board. News from Lake Wobegon. All this week.
Sunday afternoon at 2 Central Time here on WILL Urbana.
Coming up tomorrow night on WILL-TV, in concert with the Amazon Chorus, the last concert conducted by the group's founder, Christina Berger. Then stay tuned for Jay Rosenstein's documentary, Amazon Chorus, Singing Out. Don't miss the Amazon Chorus tomorrow night at 9 on our companion station, WILL-TV.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Colleen Richardson from Santa Cruz, California writes, "Dear Dr. Science, how did the Cat in the Hat get away with wearing only accessories?"
He was making a bold fashion statement that unfortunately resulted in his being incarcerated for indecent exposure. When the Dr. Seuss book first appeared back in the 50s, people were much less open-minded when it came to animal nudity. Today there's talk of a Broadway show starring the talkative cat, a blend of Cats and O Calcutta. Now me, I'll save my money and just rent the video.
Thank you, Dr. Science. Send your science questions to Ask Dr. Science. Remember, he's not a real doctor.
I have a master's degree
in science.
Produced by Duck's Breath and distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. For information about the new Dr. Science Get Smart Kit, including his new compact disc with screensaver for PCs and an honorary master's degree mouse pad, all for $21.95, call 800-989-DUCK or visit us on the web at www.drscience.com.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the University of Illinois. You'll find us online at will.uiuc.edu. Jason Croft, our technical director today. The producer for the program is Harriet Williamson. My name is Celeste Quinn. Mike Sola's forecast for Illinois and Indiana this afternoon: cloudy.